I'm speaking to David Wolf, who is the CEO of Metro's Board of Directors.
Chairman,
I'm sorry. I misspoke. David, the first question I'd like to ask, I mean, you've been the chair of the board now for 6 years. As we know, Mayor Parker is going to go a different direction and name her own chair soon at some point. So take a look back at the time that you've spent as chair, and tell me, give me your assessment of your time in office. What do you think were your best accomplishments, the things that you would have liked to have done differently? Tell me, how would you assess your time as chair?
Well, when I became chairman of Metro, I felt that I was sort of inheriting a battered child, and that Metro as an organization had been beaten up on so long and so continually that people got in the habit of doing it. In fact, I asked a friend of mine whether he thought I should take the job, and he said, well, I wouldn't do it. And I said, why not, Tom? He said, because I don't take criticism very well. But I felt that developing a first-class transit system for this city was an absolute necessity. You can't have a metropolitan area of 4 million people going to 6 million people without a very good public transit system, despite the fact that there have been some people who questioned the need for that. It was very clear to me that it was a necessity. I think that we did not start with a level playing field. I think we started deep in a hole, and that we inherited a congressional delegation that was not only divided, but was led by somebody who was radically against everything that Metro was trying to accomplish. This is extremely unusual. I don't think there's another congressional delegation in the United States that has not been fully supportive of its transit authority and its efforts to get federal funds. But for the first year or two, I had to spend time dealing with Tom DeLay and with his sidekick, John Culberson. So to look back and see what we've accomplished in this 6 years, I think is absolutely incredible. I think we've accomplished more than any other transit authority in the entire country. You have to realize there are between 75 and 100 cities competing for federal funds. And in President Obama's budget for fiscal year 2010, there are only 5 new starts in the entire country that are specified. And 2 of those new starts are Metro Houston new starts. That's pretty incredible when you realize that we started deep in the hole only 6 years ago. So we are about to receive the first federal funding that Houston has ever received for light rail funding. I believe we will shortly be receiving endorsement from the FDA for at least $900 million of light rail funding, in addition to about $91 million of stimulus funding that the FDA has sent our way. When you know that it usually takes 12 years to get through this process, and very few people do because there's so many cities competing for it, and it is a process that I've been told by the FDA itself is designed for failure, I think that this is something of which the present board and the present management should be very proud. This $900 million, I think, will be followed by another $600 million for the University Corridor, which will be a very strong applicant in about a year for federal funding, which will take us to about $1.5 billion, $1.6 billion. We will have to match that with $1.1 billion of local funds to get to the $2.7 billion sub expenditures that will be needed to build the 5 light rail lines. This isn't necessary for the city of Houston to create an infrastructure for light rail beyond which we can then expand further into the suburbs. It will address the problems of congestion and air quality and mobility which are crippling our city today and which are holding us back compared to those cities with which we are competing, such as Dallas, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, Atlanta, and so forth. Just as importantly, at this time, when Houston is suffering from some job losses, not just the Army truck contract at Sealy, but probably at NASA, probably as a result of consolidation of oil and gas service companies, such as the recent acquisition by Schlumberger of Smith, which resulted in job loss. This will be a tremendous economic benefit for the city of Houston, because when you bring in a $2.7 billion public works contract, and you have to realize this is a contract that is not being spent on perishable items, it's spent on permanent infrastructure that will pay dividends to the city of Houston for many, many decades to come. Take that. That's the most important thing. But also important, you bring $2.7 billion into this economy. Any economic development expert will tell you put a multiplier on there 3 to 5 times. So it's about a $10 billion direct income to this city, which will create about 100,000 jobs at a time when we're badly losing jobs, and create an infrastructure that is critical to moving the city forward on a competitive nature. If you compare what we have today to what, for example, Dallas has with DART, we have 7.5 miles. It happens to be the most successful light rail line ever built in the United States on a passengers per capita basis. But it's only 7.5 miles versus 42 miles. And Dallas is now going to 90 miles. And it would make you sick if you looked on the DART website to see what they have accomplished. And what they're doing is they go out to Addison, McKinney, Plano, DFW Airport, and so forth.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a couple of things that you mentioned in there. One is that...
Sorry,
that's okay. One of the, you mentioned the $2.7 million price tag. That's
billion.
One of the billion. Sorry, one of the that's one of the criticisms that people have, not just of Metro, but of sort of transit and light rail in particular, that it's so expensive. How do you address that? I mean, how do we get I guess what I would say is, are we getting our money's worth for it?
I think we will. You have to realize that's less than we spend on the expansion of an already existing I-10. I-10 already existed. The expansion cost $3 billion. These things are expensive. The I-10 interchange at Beltway 8 cost $250 million to build. These are permanent improvements, and yes, they are expensive. Now, one of the things that's making this next stage of Metro more expensive than the previous stage is that in the previous stage, they took two traffic lanes out of the middle of Main Street. And obviously that had a negative impact on Main Street. We've made the commitment we are not going to reduce traffic lanes in the corridors we're putting in light rail. Not everybody realizes this. It increases the cost, but what we're doing, for example, on Harrisburg Boulevard, where we're already under construction on the East End line, we are building two flanking lanes to add to the present four lanes. When those two flanking lanes are open, and this is preceded by a lot of underground utility construction that has to be done so that you're not putting all these improvements over leaking sanitary sewers or storm sewers that are deteriorating. Could you give me some water, David?
I will.
We build the two flanking lanes before we close the two middle lanes. So when we come in and close the two middle lanes to take that over for transit, we will have four lanes operating. That makes it much more expensive than just taking two lanes out of the middle and just killing and blowing.
Okay. What would you say Metro has learned from its experience constructing and operating the Main Street line? I mean, everyone talks about how Metro made mistakes in that they were building the whole thing at once. It negatively affected businesses. What did Metro learn, and how is it going to be different with the upcoming lines?
Well, we learned a lot. Some good things, some bad things. Let me talk about the good things first. I give full credit to the Metro Board that preceded us for getting that done. You have to realize that Tom DeLay and John Culberson signed legislation, as incredible as it seems to anybody else in the United States, which said that light rail lines could go to any other city in the country and not to Houston. The man who runs the Federal Transit Administration now, Peter Rogoff, said that one of the most incredible meetings he ever attended in the, I guess, 30 years he's been in the federal government was a meeting where DeLay sat there and crossed Houston out of funding. So they had to build this with totally local funds, and you have to give them a lot of credit, and it has been the most successful light rail line ever done in the United States. It carries 40,000 people a day, including 10,000 people a day in and out of the Texas Medical Center. Without light rail, the Texas Medical Center would completely break down. Now, yes, you do have a light rail line in the middle of Fannin, but that's where it should have been all along, and I give them credit. In terms of things we learned, one of the things we learned is not to decrease the number of traffic lanes in a boulevard or thoroughfares you're going in, and we're committed to making sure that doesn't happen. We also learned that we should do this in phases as opposed to ripping Main Street open from one end to the other. Now, in fairness to the people who did that, they were under threat of an injunction. They were afraid that they would get started on part of it and then be enjoined from completing it. So to address that issue, they just ripped it open from stem to stern. We've committed to do this in segments that will be about 4,000 feet, I believe. So we'll be in and out. Now, we may be in and out on more than one occasion because really building this, is really four phases. It's not just laying track down on the street. The first thing you have to do is go in and make sure that all the underground utilities, both dry and wet, are going to be in good shape. You've got wet utilities such as sanitary sewer, storm sewer drainage, water. Your dry utilities such as telephone, power, fiber optics. And all of those have to be the way they should be. In some cases, we're spending about $250 million out of this $2.7 billion in reconstructing utilities for the city of Houston. So you have to do the utility reconstruction in phase one. Then you'll close up the street, everything will be fine, maybe for 6 or 9 months. Then you come in and you do the flanking lanes, as I described before. That's phase two. Phase three is to come in, close the two main lanes, take them over for light rail. Put your rail tracks down in the street. Phase four is to come in with the electrification, the stations, and the landscape. So there may be times when that street is open and closed, but they'll probably be only 90 days at a stretch, and we'll move up and down a corridor so as to minimize the impact on an individual. Plus, we are establishing storefront offices on the corridor, in the street, where people can walk in and talk to people and say, gee, there's been a piece of equipment in front of my dry cleaners for 2 days. Can you get it out of here? Or what is the schedule here? When are you going to be in? When are you going to be out? Can I talk to a human being during normal business hours? This, I think, is something we learned that they did in Portland. It was very successful. Another thing we've done is we have written into our contract, I believe the number is about $5 million, as incentive to the contractor to be sensitive to the neighborhood, to keep the streets clean, to keep traffic moving, to keep access open. And that incentive will be determined by the local community as to whether that contractor gets those millions of dollars at the end of the contract. So the contractor has financial incentive to do a great job with regards to the community. I think that's a terrific idea. The fourth thing is we're setting up another $5 million, but we will give as much as $25,000 per store or per retailer or per operation to help them through this tough time. These people have to have been there for, say, 3 years before we come along. We don't want people running around and setting up companies just as we're coming in, but this is to help them through their tough time. So we're very conscious of keeping the community healthy as we are under construction so that they're there when we're done. So that's something we've learned. Another thing we've done, and this is a very complex project, as you can understand, we went to the legislature several years ago and got the legislature to allow us to do design build, which previously had been outlawed in Texas. I don't know if you're familiar with that whole process. But we had to negotiate first with the local engineering community so that we were not going to the legislature and having them fight them there. So we agreed that anything under $100 million as a project would not be subject to design build. But over $100 million, which is what we knew our major contracts would be, we could do design build. What is design build? Why do you do it? Previously, a system would be designed by one group of companies. Then it would be put out to bid for construction. The construction company might come in and say, you know, I could have built it a lot cheaper. You overspec this. Or this is a better way for it to be done, but you have the plans done this way. Another thing that would happen is the system would get built, and we found this here, and there'd be a problem. And then they would say, well, I built it the way it was designed. It's not my problem. The design was bad. Or the designer might say, it wasn't built the way I designed it. It's not my fault. And you couldn't attach responsibility. Now we have one firm doing the design and the build. So you don't have that crack in the responsibility. Even more so, sometimes a system would be designed and then it would be built and it would be tremendously inefficient. The trains would break down. It wouldn't operate properly. So we have an operating contract with the facility provider that we can ask them to operate the system for 5 years. So you know they're not going to cut corners in designing it and building it because they're going to have to operate it for 5 years. And it's called a DBOM contract, design, build, operate, maintain. They have to maintain it for 5 years. So they're going to design it and build it with an eye to how it's going to be to operate it and how it's going to be to maintain it. This is something that I don't believe has been done anywhere else in the United States, and people are coming here to study Houston Metro to see how we did this contract. Now, recently we went back. The contract originally was about 75% fixed and 25% best estimate. You know, what's the rate of inflation going to be? What are material prices going to be? We were able to negotiate so it's 98% fixed contract. So we pretty much know what it's going to cost, because in the past, almost all of these costs, when they're done, have come in way over what they were supposed to. Katy Freeway being a good example. I think it was supposed to cost $1.3 billion. Came in at $3 billion. you know, we're going to come in pretty close to cost because it's 98% fixed, and we have parent company guarantees from these companies. And not just the facility provider, which is Parsons, but all of the other people who are working on it have parent company guarantees. It's an incredible contract that management negotiated. Very few people are aware of it. But I read it and I said, this is one hell of a contract.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the criticisms that people have leveled against Metro. And I would say probably one of the prime ones you hear is that Metro isn't sufficiently transparent. Now, I'm going to break this down into two things. One, as you know, in the news right now, there's been some reports about Metro having some issues with documents going missing or being shredded. And also a recent report on Channel 11 about Metro not following state law with regards to having a document retention policy. Can you, there's pending litigation, so I know there's only so much you can talk about this, but generally speaking, what is Metro's policy with document retention, and what do you have to say about what's been reported?
Metro's policy with document retention has been excessive. We pay $81,000 a year for documents that are stored at Iron Mountain going back into the 70s. The policy, as I understand it, Metro had been to keep everything. And in the last year, people said, I think we can do a better job than that. And so we have a policy that's in place, and I think it's being updated. With regards to the, do you want me to talk about the recent document production issue?
Yes.
What would you be most interested in?
Yes.
Let me give you some specifics. This idea of shredding that came up, let me tell you how it germinated. Let me see where to begin. Well, about a year plus ago, we hired a woman by the name of Pauline Higgins to be our general counsel. There had never been a shredder in the legal office prior to Ms. Higgins' arrival. She brought in a very large shredder. She brought in a shredder that was in her personal office. Prior to that, the general counsel tells me there had never been a shredder in the legal office. She established somewhat of a siege mentality in the general office, in the law office, I should say, in that people from Metro, even though they were within the secure building, could not walk into the legal department as had been previously possible. She locked the whole office off, and you had to use a telephone to get into the legal office. Strange. In any case, there was a shredder there. Well, with regards to the document request from Mr. Lloyd Kelly, these documents were prepared and completed on Friday, February 19th. And here is a letter to Mr. Kelly, which was faxed to him on February 19th, which is a Friday, saying your documents are ready to be picked up.
As I recall, he subsequently told the Houston Chronicle that he didn't get that.
Well, we have a fax receipt attached to this that he did. Maybe his fax machine is broken down. But it was sent to him on Friday, February 19th, and you have a copy of it now.
I'm holding a copy of it now.
So Mr. Kelly was faxed these documents. Received a fax saying the documents are ready to be picked up. And that was sent on Friday, February 19th. Now, he filed a lawsuit the following Wednesday, I believe, saying that we had not been responsive to his document request. I think this is all very much tied to the discharge of this one general counsel. It's not coincidental. The decision was reached really the prior Thursday, which is February 18th, that this woman could no longer stay at Metro. And I can show you an email which you will understand, which you probably have not seen. I might want to take a moment to read it.
I'm looking at an email from Pauline Higgins to Frank Wilson saying, I do not like what you have done to me and my remaining Office of General Counsel staff, what you have already done and are currently doing to subvert, misrepresent, including what transpired today in executive session regarding your knowledge of Metroplex Corps, and undermine the Office of the General Counsel, which is here to protect the best interests of the authority of the client. Further, in light of all that is transpiring, you disrespect me, humiliate, defame, slander, investigate, by your employee advocate, and libel me and my reputation through unsavory actions, all of which have been and are currently taking place behind my back. I have retained Rusty Hardin as my personal legal counsel to advise me through these witch hunts. Mr. Hardin is copied on this email. I'll be happy to discuss the two emails that you presented to me today in the presence of my legal counsel, Mr. Harden. I'm experiencing, and this is, a hostile and discriminatory work environment. Signed, Pauline, dated Thursday, February 18th at 3:51 p.m.
Now, if you talk to any chief executive officer of any company, and he receives an email like that from his general counsel, which not only tells him what a bad person he is, but says, I've hired Rusty Harden to represent me. You don't call that person and say, I'm looking forward to a long and continuing employment relationship with you as general counsel. What you say is, this person has to be separated from this company. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. I guess my question is, it sounds like there may, you know, the problems that you are talking about here might have been somewhat long-standing. It makes me wonder, why didn't this come to a head earlier?
Well, I think that's a good question. In fact, today there will be released a study that was done regarding Pauline Higgins in December, which recommended that she be terminated because she had brutalized so many of the employees in the law office. Four of those people, I better not get into that beyond that. This will be the subject of litigation. I'm sure there will be a lawsuit about unjust termination. But the study will be released today, which recommended her termination in December. Quite frankly, it was a difficult situation. We knew the type of person she was. We were, I guess, Frank Wilson, I guess, was hoping that she would leave on her own. She was not getting along with the people there. We knew, though, that given her nature, the fact that she was a lawyer, and other factors which you can figure out for yourself, we thought, this person cannot stay, but it would be great if she were offered another opportunity somewhere else. This was sort of the final trigger. We were trying to, you know, Frank was trying to work with this woman. But then this was it.
Okay. Let's go to the other part of my question regarding transparency. One often hears in the news from different neighborhood groups or other advocacy groups that complain that Metro has not been forthcoming with them in terms of their plans. An example I'll cite is with Harrisburg, where some residents of the area have complained about a rail maintenance facility that's being built or planned to be built on Harrisburg, which they say was not part of what the original plan. They didn't know about it until all of a sudden it showed up. Can you speak to that or speak more generally towards the reputation that Metro has as not being sufficiently transparent?
I think Metro is extremely transparent. And I'll give you some examples first, and then I'll talk about Harrisburg. If you were to come to our monthly board meeting, you would see Metro's cash position. You would see how that money is invested, what the interest is that's received. You would see a monthly update of the budget. You would see reports on how many bus accidents there have been, how many rail accidents there have been, what the miles are. Incidentally, would you like to guess how many miles it is between bus accidents?
I have no idea.
It's over 100,000 miles between bus accidents. It's a very good credit, a safety record. Metro has its accounting reviewed, audited by an independent auditor each year, KPMG. That financial statement is available to anybody who wants to see it. I think the Metro is very transparent. I think this is an unfortunate rumor that just sort of gets repeated. I asked one elected official why she said this. I said, can you give me examples how Metro is not transparent and accountable? She said, well, I heard it during the campaign. I don't think there's substance to it. I don't know of any entity that is as transparent as Metro is. With regards to the repair facility on Harrisburg, I can't say that when the rail line was originally envisioned that it was shown to be there. But it should not be surprising to people that you have to have operating facilities for rail lines, and B, it was placed in an entirely appropriate location. If you go out and look at the site, you'll see that it is bordered on two sides by railroad tracks. In fact, it was a former pipe yard. This was not a residential area that was acquired for a rail repair facility. The rail repair facility would be much more attractive than what was there before. What is more important is that if you drive, have you driven Harrisburg lately?
Not very recently, no.
You're not alone. If you go out Harrisburg, you will see that there used to be employment centers out there, and they're losing them one by one. They lost Hughes Tool. They lost Stewart and Stevenson. The coffee plant is no longer General Foods. I suspect it's much downsized. What that area needs is employment. That's what it needs for life. there are going to be very good jobs for the people in this neighborhood. They're very high quality, blue collar jobs. And that's what this facility will provide. In fact, we're working with Houston Community College to help train people in the neighborhood so that they will be able to work at this facility. And it's located on an entirely appropriate site in an industrial area. And so I think any objection to it, I don't really understand. I think it'll be a great benefit to the area.
Okay. Recently, Bill King, among others, has suggested that Metro should reduce or even consider doing away with fares as a way of increasing ridership. Mayor Parker has signaled that she is at least open to considering such possibilities. What do you say about that?
Well, I think maybe we should consider doing away with property taxes. I think everybody would be very happy about that for a short term until they found they no longer had firemen responding to fire calls and policemen responding to crime. I think that Metro could not operate without these revenues. It would, first of all, make it impossible for us to sell revenue bonds. And revenue bonds are part of the matching funds that we're going to raise to pay for this $2.7 billion project. It's not unusual at all. This has been tried in a few other cities. I don't think that the absence of fares is what leads to ridership. We have some examples here in Houston. There have been examples in Austin. They tried it in Austin, and from what I told, it was a dismal failure. In Houston, actually, we had the downtown shuttle, which you might remember when the streets were torn up. The downtown shuttle was discontinued because ridership just dropped off the charts once the streets were finished. Free buses don't put people out there. What puts people on the buses are clean buses, on time, reliable, or clean trains, taking people from where they are to where they have to go. Also, there's the problem that if you didn't charge fares, you might end up with a rolling homeless center, which would scare away all the good people who should be on the trains, who are going to their jobs, going to their doctor, and so forth.
Okay. I guess another thing that people have said is that Metro's financial position is not as good as it could be, and that they can't afford all the money that we've been talking about.
See, and again, you're damned if you do, damned if you
don't. I know.
If you run a solid, you know, the FTA, when they heard the idea of eliminating fares, said, why are you taking one of the few healthy transit authorities in the United States and threatening its financial viability? It's a silly idea. If you look around the country, almost every other transit authority is laying people off, cutting service. We're expanding service. We're buying 100 new hybrid buses a year. We're about to embark on the greatest public work project in the history of the city. You don't take a healthy system and gut it by taking out $70 million a year, which is going to go to $100 million a year when we have the rail.
Okay.
In terms of Metro's financial stability, let me tell you, the federal government does not give $1 billion to you without being darn sure that you're going to be able to handle what you say you're going to do and be financially viable. They have scrubbed Metro in for years, and if you talk to the FTA, they will say they are very satisfied with our financial viability. One way we've done that is we've kept our costs constant. Now, we've had some criticism that we have discontinued some routes. I was involved in that. When you are spending 11% of your vehicle miles to carry 3% of your passengers, you are wasting public money. We have a great responsibility to those people who ride Metro, but we have a great responsibility to those people who pay the sales tax, who are part of the public. They have a reason to expect us to handle their money carefully. By eliminating those 11% of vehicle miles that were carrying 3% of our people, we're able now to go out and buy new buses. Metro had quit buying new buses. We had a 1,600 bus fleet, 400 of which didn't leave the yard ever. We're now buying 100 new hybrid buses a year. This is cleaner air. This is better service. This is greater distance between breakdowns. This is better service for those people. We care about those people who have to ride Metro. We care about those people for whom it's an option. And part of the way to get good ridership is to have a good bus system that is running in an efficient way and in a clean way and a courteous way. And we're adding new service. People don't ever give us credit for that. We're doing some things that are very much out of the box, to use that term. For example, we just started the first reverse commute system that's ever been done in this city. We are now running park and ride buses from the inner city out to the energy corridor every day, so that the people who are in the inner city who don't have a car can access the 75,000 excellent white-collar jobs in the energy corridor. We got $3 million from the federal government to do that. And then we're connecting that with the energy corridor management district to do a circulator from that to take people to Shell and BP and ConocoPhillips and all those great employers out there. This is something that's never been done before. We are running north-south service through West Houston, down Fountain View and Renwick, to serve a very transit-intensive corridor so that people don't have to go in and then come out. We are running contract services that has not been done before to areas outside of our service area. Baytown, Pearland, well, Baytown now, Pasadena now, Pearland soon. So that they're outside our service area. Someday we want them to be inside the metro service area, so we're contracting with Harris County or what have you to run metro buses out there. We're doing it in an efficient way. For example, the bus that goes to Baytown, we take the park and ride that goes to Maxey Road, and we're extending it out to Baytown. So we're not charging them from downtown to Baytown. They're just paying the incremental cost from Maxey Road out to Baytown. So this is innovative. And so we care about the people who don't have alternative forms of transportation. You have to realize MetroLift, which we operate, if you go to the medical center, you'll see MetroLift vans all over the medical center, taking people who don't have a way to get to the doctor, picking them up in their wheelchairs, taking them to the doctor, bringing them home for free. Handicapped people ride for half fare. People over 60 or 62 ride for half fare. Anybody over 72 is free. Students ride for half fare. Our fares are the lowest in the country for a major transit system. Our book fare is $1.25. Every 50 fares you get 5 free, so it's really $1.12.5 if you're a frequent rider. And so many people get half fares or free fares. Our average fare is 70 cents. Knocking out that 70 cents isn't going to make... You can't buy a Coke for 70 cents. You can ride all the way across the city of Houston on a good bus for 70 cents or $1.12, you want to say. Fares are not the issue. The real agenda of people who are doing that is trying to denigrate mass transit as a way to get around Houston. They are saying in the same breath, oh, transit is just for people who don't have an alternative. That's nonsense. A good transit system carries all elements of the population, all ethnic groups, all ages, for all reasons.
Okay. Right now, one of the things that's being talked about is commuter rail down to Galveston and potentially out 290. The Gulf Coast Freight Rail District is kind of the one driving that right now. County Judge Ed Emmett has said that he doesn't really want Metro to be doing this right now. What do you think? You know, what do you think about that? What should, you know, how should commuter rail be developed and integrated with the existing system?
Well, the first thing you have to understand is that before you have commuter rail, you have to have a light rail system, because commuter rail cannot deliver people into the center of the medical center. It can't deliver them into the center of the uptown area, into downtown. So you have to, it's like building a house. You have to do the framework before you start thinking about what the siding is going to look like, what you're going to put on the roof, and so forth. And so the light rail system is the framework into which commuter rail will be attached. With regards to who should operate it, obviously Metro, I believe, has earned that responsibility. Metro is in the passenger train business today. The Gulf Coast Freight Rail District, I believe, was set up to eliminate the numerous grade rail crossings that we have. To date, I don't think they've been able to accomplish anything. I don't think they have any funding. I don't think they have staff. They've never been in the passenger rail business, nor has the county. So I think Metro should do this, and I think Metro can do this. And I think that the commuter rail has to interchange with the Metro light rail system in order to operate properly, because people aren't going to want to come in on commuter rail and get off and then walk 2 miles or catch a bus or something. They're going to want to go commuter rail to light rail. That's the obvious projection. Something that has not been announced yet, but is imminent and will come after I step down as Metro chairman, is probably the first real movement forward on commuter rail. And this illustrates my point. We have been working, I met this week with Congressman Al Green, with two of the Fort Bend County commissioners, with the mayor of Richmond, the mayor of Missouri City, Stafford, Netta's Place. It was a very broad group of people. They came to us and they said, we would like to talk to you about commuter rail to the Fort Bend County line, with the idea that will be extended past the Fort Bend County line, which happens to be Beltway 8 on the 98 corridor. The idea that it will be extended to Sugar Land and then ultimately to Richmond-Rosenberg. We want to work with Metro. We would not talk to you about buses. We don't want your buses in Fort Bend County, but we want your trains. And this is the point that people have to understand about this idea of cutting out fares, or people say, well, why don't they just run buses? Because trains have a different image in people's minds. 40% of the people who ride Metro Rail never rode Metro before. And if you're going to get a broad base of support and serve a broad base of the population, which is what you have to do when your sales tax supported and your voters supported, you have to provide better means of transportation. So we're working with them. We believe we have a plan to build, I believe it's 7.5 miles of rail from the present Fannin South terminus of the Main Street Rail Line out the 98 corridor to the county line, and eventually that will extend further. What they said to us previously, the Fort Bend County judge, Mr. Hebert, had been against Metro coming into Fort Bend County. But he says now, I've listened to my mayors want Metro there, they want Metro Rail, and I will support them. This is with Congressman Al Green's leadership, and he is saying that he will work to make this happen, and there will be a resolution presented at the Thursday, March 18th meeting of the Metro Board, assuming that the Metro Board supports me on this, and it's up to them because our board operates, I don't control the board, I'm only one of 9 members. You have to realize that the city of Houston has a very slim majority on that board, 5 members out of 9. 2 of the others are appointed by the multi-city mayors in the service area, 2 of the others by the Harris County Commissioners Court. And our board works together. It doesn't fracture along who appointed them. I think it's important that the city of Houston not lose track of that fact, that this board has to work as one entity. We can't dictate to the other 4, this is what we're going to do. We're going to eliminate fares. One thing that wasn't mentioned was when the Metro City, when the multi-city mayors heard about the idea of eliminating fares, they went ballistic. Jimmy Stewart, who represents the multi-city mayors, said his phone started ringing at 7:30 in the morning.
Okay. One last question.
I've been pretty wordy, I'm sorry.
No, it's been very interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time. We could go a lot longer, but to try and wrap this up, what advice would you give Mayor Parker in how she should go about selecting your replacement? And what do you think should be the top priority that the next mayor, next Metro chair should have?
Well, I've spent 6 years of my life working on this effort, now 6+, because I really wanted to step down with Mayor Bill White on January 2nd or January 3rd, whenever Bill left office. And I've only stayed around as an accommodation to Mayor Parker to help her in this transition. Believe me, after 6 years in this job, I was ready to go and expected to be able to go on January 2nd. I'm surprised that it's taken so long to replace me. What advice would I give her with regards to a new chair? Was that your question?
Yes.
Find somebody who's nuts. It takes a tremendous amount of time if you're going to do the job properly. I thought it would take 25% of my time. It has easily taken 50% of my time and more than that of my emotional capacity. I'm very fortunate that I have wonderful people here at Wolf Companies who can operate without my being here all the time. We've been in business for over 40 years, and we've managed to be successful through all the vicissitudes of the real estate development industry in Houston. And you have to find somebody who can take about 50% of their time and do this. Also, you work for free. So you have to find somebody who's willing to spend 50% of their time working for free. I'm already getting close to the definition of insanity here. Plus, you have to find somebody of very high energy because there is a crisis a minute. This thing that came up on the document production, it's total nonsense, but it'll take a few weeks to clean it up. Pauline Higgins, that'll probably take a few months, maybe a year, to clean it up. But that's, if I went over all the problems that I've encountered, all the crises, all the issues over 6 years, it would turn your hair gray, and right now it's nice and brown. I looked like Rick Perry when I started this job. you have to, I wrote out for George Grinius, he said, what are the competencies required for a board chair. You have to understand finance. You have to understand accounting. You have to understand how to work with people. You have to understand how to deal with lawyers, how to work with government officials, how to work with the media. In terms of government officials, you realize that Metro has to work with 8 different levels of elected officials.
Wow.
You have to work with the mayor, with the city council, the county commissioners, state representatives, state senators, U.S. congressmen, U.S. senators, and the president. Most people report to one elected body. We report to 8. We get appointed by local bodies. We have to work with local, but our money comes from the feds. That's the source of all of it. So those are the competencies required. It has to be somebody who, as Bob Lanier told me, has a thick skin and a short memory. You know, he said that the problem with him was he had a thin skin and a long memory. Because for some reason, people in Houston like to beat up on Metro. But this is incredible to me. Because this is our best hope of getting a mass transit system ever in this region. And it's like raising a child and telling them that they're dumb, stupid, and lazy and expecting them to be self-respecting and productive adults. I felt that one of my responsibilities at Metro was to stand up and take the hits for the people at Metro. To protect them. Because how are you going to get a good person like John Sedlak, who's been there for 25 years, and every week there's criticism of Metro. And a lot of it is totally unjustified and totally untrue. But it's a fact of life. It gets reported in the newspapers. I mean, this shredding never happened.
Okay. David Wolf, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me today. I appreciate it.